You're listening to HG 101, a proud part of the Greenlit Podcast Network. Hey there, loyal listeners. As you know, the Top Games Podcast is made possible by Hardcore Gaming 101's Patreon supporters, who help keep this show alive by donating as little as $2 each month. If you were to join them in doing that, you would not only help keep the lights on at HG 101 Towers, you'd also get access to our super secret Patreon RSS feed, which is full of ad-free versions of this podcast with exclusive bonus game rankings. Here's a taste of what you've been missing. We're going to be ranking a game we nominated for ourselves, Oregon Trail Deluxe.
Basically, your whole goal is to get from Missouri to Oregon.
If you get to the end, it doesn't matter how much of your family dies as long as you're there, right?
Well, it actually does matter if you're playing for score, because having everyone is about 2,000 points.
It's 1992. I'm in the computer lab at my school. What I'm playing for is to not be reading or doing anything else. So I'm playing, for that. And then also you get to leave funny tombstones when your kids die. So that's like the real reward of the game, is when your kid dies of dysentery, you get to say, like, Boogerman died of dysentery.
Go to patreon.com/HG101 and pledge a couple bucks. That's patreon.com/HG101. Act now and be a hero.
For some, this is painfully obvious, but hardcore gaming means it ain't for the novices. The main source to brain train your knowledge and lay maintain with a course aimed at colleges. To HG101, we give the honor. Thanks to Kirk, a lot of Xerxes to host it proper, as well as Satanga, Cal and Bobinator, Ogre Hart and others discuss and discover all the 47,000 games. And when they rate them, you can bet it's scientifically locked in position. Speaking of which, no system is obscure. And look, they wrote a book about it. Go out and cop yours.
Hello and welcome to HardcoreGaming101.net's Top 47,858 Games of All Time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games that you nominate. My name is Xerxes, and I'm the show's main host and producer, and on this podcast we have three rules. Rule 1, all rankings are final, official, and scientifically accurate. Rule 2, you can nominate one game at a time via 5-star review on iTunes or Stitcher. Those are the ones we try to get to first. You can also go to bit.ly/rankthisplease. and add a game to the slush pile and cross your fingers. We make no guarantees on those. Rule number 3, you can nominate games that have already been nominated, but just don't nominate games you've already ranked. See the master list for yourself. It's at bit.ly/47kgames. That's bit.ly/47kgames.
Dog's power. Hey, dog's power. Hey, dog's power. Hey, dog's power.
I don't know.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to this show. Another episode of this show. We're going to be talking about Wizardry, Proving Grounds of the Mad Overlord, which was nominated by Bisafreddy on Apple Podcasts Brazil. And again, Bisafreddy, if you're still listening to our terrible show, I'm sorry it took us so long to figure out that you nominate games, but we did, and now we're doing it. This game was developed by Certex Software Incorporated and published by Certex Software Incorporated for the Apple II in September 1981. Who knows the exact date? Who's with me to talk about Wizardry, Proving Grounds of the Mad Overlord?
I'm Tex Lepin.
Yeah. You wait that long, I'll go first.
And I'm the Great Clade.
Our show is terrible. So, now, okay.
We tried to go in alphabetical order, right? That's tactical.
No, we never have played, then me. Ever. We don't do that.
That's why we have a guy named Xerxes go first.
That's exactly right. Then I don't even give my name because I'm on the intro to the show. And that's probably going to get changed very soon. In fact, I may even have to change this.
The introductions are more like a Mexican standoff. Like, nobody wants to go first, and then everybody shuts shooting.
It's like
the
end.
Time.
It's like the very end of the good, the bad, and the ugly. Except,
except everyone's the ugly, right?
Yeah, every one of us is Eli Wallach. Yeah. So, great movie. Check it out, kids.
It's fantastic.
Like on a top 47,000 list, where do we put the good, the bad, and the ugly?
I would. I mean, it's almost as old as Wizardry if you think about it.
It's just actually
probably
really
older than Wizardry.
Yeah, 1969, I think. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Wizardry, 1981. I mean,
this game,
it's an oldie but a goodie. This is one of the. I always think of it as part of like a kind of a trinity of old school Apple II dungeon crawlers, but I can only think of Wizardry and the Bard's Tale. What's the one I'm forgetting? What is it?
Ultima.
Magic?
Maybe?
I thought I would have said Ultima.
But it's not really a dungeon crawler.
Not really. No, it's not a pure dungeon crawler like this one here.
Well, no. I also had an argument about this Magic, so...
The Ultima predecessor, what's it called again? Akalabeth?
Akalabeth.
Yeah, that is a dungeon crawler.
That's a dungeon crawler.
I guess it's probably Ultima.
I always call Wizardry the big three between Ultima, Might and Magic, and Wizardry. Because all three ended about the same time in fairly similar fashions.
Oh, Wizardry never ended. It just depends on what country you're in.
Well, okay. Yeah. What we properly call Wizardry, and then whatever Japan picked up, and then, like, hey. I think they picked up Wizardry 4, and they're like, well, we'll take this, guys, and everyone's like, no, but we made more, and like, nah, we're good.
Creator of Wizardry moved to Japan and made that game. So, be careful what you're saying here. We might as well talk, like, look, if you really want to know about Wizardry, it's a classic RPG dungeon crawler. It's like a post-mainframe game, so it's not like D&D, whatever the original one was, but
it was just D&D.
Yeah, D, literally D, lowercase d, lowercase n, lowercase d.
We hadn't invented capital letters at the point, children.
No, they hadn't. Yeah, and it was, you know, one of those games where you'd like play it at night and hope that nobody discovered it on the computer and erased it. You disguised it as a some kind of educational software or whatever it was. But no, this game was made by a college dropout, essentially. Robert Woodhead and Andrew, what's his name? Andrew.
Tell you what, so just in case anyone's aware, I have the actual manual to this game in my hands as we speak, and it is Andrew Greenberg and Robert Woodhead.
Yeah, so Robert Woodhead went to school, went to college, and dropped out of college. And if you want to hear the whole story, there's a great Retronauts interview with Robert Woodhead it's about probably a year and a half old now, but it's one of their finest episodes. It's just Jeremy Parrish and Robert Woodhead, and he just like gives the whole lowdown, gives you exactly what you expect, which is like he was a young man, kind of a ne'er-do-well. And instead of dropping out of college and forming a democracy-crushing social network, what he did was he made a cool video game. And it was, like, wildly successful. And it took his life in really crazy places. But it started out as just being – he was a big fan of Dungeons & Dragons, as you can imagine. And he wanted to make a computer game that was kind of like that for the Apple II. And he did. And this is it.
To give a scope of how games were developed in this day, the testing staff lists five people. Three of them have the last name of Woodhead.
Good observation there.
And the only reason why this game came in an actual box and not in a zip bag is because one of the creator's fathers insisted that this should be somewhat professional.
Also, we're using those Ziploc bags, damn it, Robert.
Yeah, these are for sandwiches. You can put your... You put your games and stuff in like boxes. I don't know. I mean, now they, Sirtech is I think it was kind of like its own. It was again in the tradition of BioWare and other things. It was a software company that was probably, I believe it was made, it was established to do something else, but they ended up doing games.
Yeah. That, I wish I had remembered to look that up, because as soon as you told that story, I kind of remember reading that now.
So while you fuss around there, you did mention that this is kind of like D&D, and I want to say, for the game itself, that's what makes this work. It's not exactly D&D.
Oh, but my God, it tries.
It manages to deftly be just not enough like D&D that it's actually fun.
I believe there's also a Retronauts that's from maybe slightly earlier than this one, but it's – listen to Retronauts, kids. It's a great show. It's better than ours. But no, there's another – it's where they interview a guy who worked on Bard's Tale, and he says kind of the same thing. His whole point was that he was really into pen and paper RPGs, Dungeons & Dragons, but he really hated how playing a pen and paper game kind of encourages you to fudge the rules. And he didn't like that. I don't think that was – the spear behind this game, but his whole point was like, you should make a game if it's on a computer where the computer is the dungeon master and the rules cannot be violated. They will always be what they are. You can't mess with them. But I can kind of see some of that spirit in this game too. I guess we should introduce the story such as it is.
It's in the manual.
It has a manual.
It does.
The game does not talk about the story. It just literally boots up. It's, would you like to play the game? Let's go.
It doesn't even ask you that. You got to play the game. You boot it up.
Actually, you boot it up and it tells you, do you want to play the game or make a scenario disc? And you don't need to make a scenario disc, anyone.
No.
The basic story is just that a guy whose name is just Andrew Backwards, he has a magical amulet.
Yes.
And uses it to create a dungeon, which is 10 levels. And you have to stab him and then take the amulet.
Yes, that's part of the story. The other guy whose name is Robert Backwards, King Trebor. I believe he is the Mad Overlord.
He's the Mad Overlord.
Although going back to the manual, it is Trebor the Mad Overload in this.
Mad Overload. It's pretty good.
Not even kidding. I'm looking right at that.
Continued throughout the rest of the manual.
They must have kept it for prosperity because they took multiple cracks at that manual.
The word you want is posterity, and you just proved your point.
Posterity? No, that's your ass.
You said...
You're good at English. I don't know if anyone's ever told you this, Cal.
Thank you.
What you mean? Nobody's
ever told you that before.
Posterity. Look, this game is not for smart people. It's for people like us. So, no, I'm just kidding.
People enjoy looking at black and white lines.
It's great. I love this game.
It's very pure.
I thought you were kidding when you said that earlier. Are you actually?
I am not kidding. I look, here's the other thing is you don't play the PC versions of this game. Don't play the Apple II version. Don't play the IBM version. Play the NES version because that's what game creator Robert Woodhead prefers. He likes that version of the game the best, and that's the one you should play. So it's pretty much the same, though. It just has some of the rough edges kind of sanded down a little bit, but it's still very obtuse.
It also has a major bug, which was just introduced in the NES version. The bug. So armor class doesn't work in that game, so armor has no effect. It gives you the value, but it doesn't do anything.
What?
Yep.
Oh, you know, that sounds right. Because I've always felt the NES game version or the NES was a lot harder.
I didn't have any problem at all.
Did you get a patch?
It works both ways. It depends on what equipment you find and what monsters you encounter, so it can work both ways. It doesn't have to make the game harder. And I think the Apple II version, especially the non-revised one, is still harder.
That might be possible, but I just remember getting hit a lot more in that one than this one. Man, once again, playing Wizardry for the first time is like kissing for the first time. You want to do it right, and you're not exactly sure what you're supposed to do.
That's a quote from the manual. You can't, thank you.
But the hints are there for those who want them.
Yeah, the hint is probably that you just grind up your first couple of parties and then loot their still warm corpses for more money.
This is an obtuse metaphor.
This is getting crazy, and I love
that's it. That's not like a metaphor. That's literally what you do. Your first party just gets killed immediately.
That's what happened to me.
Another one, and then you just take the stuff from the first party.
I didn't take them. I didn't find them yet. I just made a new party.
Well, there's also like stuff you could do where like you can't have parties with like evil and good character alignments in the same party, but you can do it. I think if you just like create a party of evil people and dump them into the maze, and then you can
Because that's how you get ninjas and lords in the same party.
Which is great. And I love that the game does stuff like that. But we should talk a little bit more about the game. So you mentioned armor class, Clade. So that is the level of D&D slavishness that the game goes for. It's there.
Yes.
Can you explain how that works?
Okay. So armor class is literally like on a scale of, -10 to 10, how good your armor is. Once again, to go back to the manual, because I love this thing, it crunches it between a character, Bearskin, for example, has an armor class of 10. A character with an armor class of -10 is about as well armored as a Sherman tank. And then how it works in this game, so that's sort of the idea, is the lower your armor class, the harder you are to hit. Unlike D&D, I actually don't know how the math in this game works, so that's about the best I can give you.
I would bet it's pretty similar, because again, they weren't like, when they were making this game, they were not game designers at that point. They were amateur programmers who were trying to make a D&D game. So I'll bet that they didn't like improvise too much of the math. I will say that I don't think the armor class, looking this up, I don't think that the armor class thing is a bug that is omnipresent in the game. It's just for certain monsters, it's the melee hit chances will remain the same regardless of your armor class values.
Okay, so they just cut through it. Yeah, the idea behind armor class is that, and the reason why negative armor class is better is because armor class essentially works as a bonus to your opponent's hit roll. That's why you'd think higher would be better, as it is the case.
Yeah,
it's not another right. A person, but here the lower the number is, the better it is. Which Dungeons & Dragons kept for a while, but it was revised eventually. They kept the math intact, but the presentation was changed.
So there is a ROM hack for the NES version that does fix that, by the way. You can find it on romhacking.net.
There's also a Famicom version of this game. I don't know if there
is. I don't think that's been totally, fully, completely translated.
It's
a Super Famicom version, are we sure?
It's how I usually play the game.
Ooh.
It is fully translated?
It is. I've played through, I think, all of the first Wizardry on that one. And so,
Gamer have gone out and played the PC Apple game on a Super Famicom rather than play it on a keyboard, which makes you a monster.
It does make me a monster, and Feynman himself should throw me out of the club. But, what was I going to say now? The Super Famicom version of the game possesses all three of the scenarios, because while we call this Wizardry 1, the full title is Wizardry Scenario 1, Proving Grounds of the Mad Overlord. And the idea was you were supposed to be able to make a... So, going back to the D&D is kind of a system of like adventures. And then you take a system of adventures is what you call a campaign. And you play you play one character through a campaign, through a series of adventures. And the idea that Wizardry was going to do was it was going to all be kind of the same game, but they were going to keep making new scenarios. And it kind of stopped after three, because then once this came around, everyone was like exploding past them technically and everything. So they were like, well, why do I want to play another Wizardry that looks like the first game from 1981,
right,
when I've got fancy bards.
Well, it was the Pokemon problem. You could import your party into the subsequent games, but at a certain point, it's like, well, we can keep track of a lot more things, and we don't need to use the same stats and things. Like, why would you do that?
Plus, Wizardry 3 having that whole Star Child thing, because they've ruined the whole franchise.
Yeah. Well, no, Wizardry 3. Like, by the time Wizardry 3 came around, they were like... Because one problem with Wizardry 2 was if you had a person die in Wizardry 2 and you were playing technically correct, you had to go back to Wizardry 1 to bring him... or to put your character back up to strength to have him play in Wizardry 2. It was ridiculous.
It was weird, but they were trying to keep it real. Like, that's just an example of when keeping it real goes wrong, right?
Yep. So going back to my point, though, the Super Famicom version has all three of the proper original scenarios where you can go, you take your character from 1 to 2 to 3. And the NES games, there's also three, all three of them are on the NES, but rather than, because you can't clearly, you don't have floppy disks on an NES, so they just give you passwords.
Did you just say you don't have floppy disks on an NES when that is actually where they had floppy disks?
They had them on the Famicom, you pedantic person.
The Famicom disk system, that's not the NES per se.
Exactly, I win this round.
Are you really going to say that it's not the Nintendo
system? Yes, I am, because if you're going to play this game with
all
me.
Of you, and I am moving on. So,
can we talk about Wizardry, just the first game?
Yeah, Wizardry is, again, you don't have to play the NES version. I guess there's a fully translated SNES patch out there somewhere. I didn't find it. Perhaps that's the way to play.
I mean, the game is like half translated as it is.
The interesting thing is that Wizardry has taken on a life of its own in Japan. It, like, this game has an OVA, an original video animation. Is that what that stands for?
I don't know why it's that order, but that's the way it works, yes.
Yeah. It has a cartoon movie that you can watch for free in its entirety on YouTube. not great, but it tells you the entire story plus a bunch of extra stuff. And it's interesting because the person who translated the cartoon like tells you what spells are the characters are using at any given time. And it does correlate directly to the spells in the game. It's quite weird, quite wonderful.
I like the way the cartoon is.
Does the cartoon have him like constantly casting Duma Pick because he keeps forgetting to write down his coordinates?
No, it's not that literal, but yes, that is exactly how the game works. It is a game. As we said, it's a dungeon crawler or a dungeon hack or whatever you want to call it, which means you're working your way through a first person maze. You do really need graph paper or the internet, one of the two. But if you want to do it the old school way,
are they regenerated or is it just one maze that you're stuck in?
Like the game, if you, any map you make works for this game. Really quick, because I'm guessing that Xerxes and Cal do not actually own copies of Wizardry. The copies you said you were playing the NES version.
I do own that, yes.
Okay, well, I was gonna, Cal, you said you were playing the DOS version. At the base of the stairs, did you find a body with a key at it?
No.
Okay, so I guess that was just my luck forever. One thing that should be noted about Wizardry is the save file is tied to, like, how to put this? You don't have your save file tied in Wizardry to your characters. For example, like we mentioned, if your party dies, that's not game over. That's all your characters are dead, and they're lying in that maze somewhere. You don't necessarily play as any of your characters. I always like to call Wizardry Adventure Simulator Manager 1981. Because you're just kind of boosting up adventurers and you take them through. And so what'll happen is, like, on abandonware sites, there are copies of Wizardry floating around where if you don't delete all the characters, some guy took the key and he just put it at the start of the level. It's just laying right there. And that's how Wizardry works, is, like, the map is not only is the map not randomly generated, it keeps track of everything on it.
It does.
If you drop something, I think, in the middle of the map, it'll still be there. The game saves, I think it's every step.
Yeah,
like it does. If you play this like an Apple II, every step you go chunk, chunk.
I would say, I think even on the NES, it technically saves every step. I think it really does.
Possible. Yeah. I have no idea how that would work because it seems like it would set your NES on fire. But
it's because it's a very simplistic game. Like, there's not much going on there. I mean, except for the math and the numbers and the saves. Yeah, everything else is incredibly bare bones.
The original version was super slow, so they actually waited a while to release it because it would run better on later, better hardware.
That's great. I can't believe we've got the original Crisis here.
Yeah. I mean, they were just kids, you know. Making this game. And what's interesting is, like, if you listen to the Retronauts episode again, like, Robert Woodhead describes how he took this game to Japan in the mid 80s and kind of, I don't know whether it was exactly his doing, but for whatever reason, it caught on there. And he was, you know, working on the ports and stuff to Japanese microcomputers. He, I believe, when he first went there, he met a representative from ASCII, the publisher.
Yeah.
And he had a translator with him and all that. And they talked about the game and he ended up, you know, selling it to that publisher and ended up marrying the translator and stayed in Japan for quite a while and ended up doing some of the, you know, he made Wizardry 4 while living in Japan. And I think he did it on like a PC-88. I'm not entirely sure, but you got to listen to that episode. I can't remember, but he did.
PC-88 would have been sort of anywhere in the 80s. So if he did it in the 80s, it was probably PC-88.
Yeah.
It was complicated. There's like a complicated like thing where he was like using a PC-88 to emulate an Apple II or something like that.
Yeah, that sounds like development.
Yeah.
So,
and
go ahead.
Sorry. What's interesting, as Clade said, is that you can, in the PC versions of the game, or I think any version of the game, you can transfer your party to the next game or the next scenario up to Wizardry 3. The very interesting thing about this is, one kind of side note, is you can also transfer your your party into like Bard's Tale just for no reason at all. That just because Bard's Tale people liked wizardry, so they let you do that.
Also, the name Skara Brae appears in this like story. I'm not entirely sure. There's some big long myth about Skara Brae that goes well beyond video games. That's more of a tax thing, I'm sure. But
tax?
Yes.
He doesn't know anything about Skara Brae.
He doesn't know anything about it. Okay,
I guess.
So it's not no, I do not.
Well, okay. So Skara Brae shows up and like
look. I'm still busy wrapping my head around like the 39 different Japanese-only spin-offs of this game here.
Is it Wizardry Gaiden? Wizardry Gaiden 2?
Wizardry is just owned by a Japanese company at this point.
Now it is, yes. Yeah. Now it is.
It makes a great game.
Crazy that it caught on over there because it is the antithesis to every Japanese RPG I have ever played.
Yes!
Even Etrian Odyssey is like...
I'm going to give you like a mild, like, because this is not too dissimilar from the PC and Japanese computer RPGs that were around. Quite a few of them were, honestly, a lot of the dungeon crawlers they had were really, really bad. Had nice art, but very broken. This game, not so nice art, but not broken in a way that's frustrating to the player, really. I will say just one more thing about why it might have caught on. Two of the four like top classes are samurai and ninja. And I don't know if that was just like, hey, cool representation of our stuff in here.
Here's what it was, is according to Robert Woodhead, he was watching the James Clavell's Shogun adaptation into like a TV movie series at the time he was making this game, or maybe a little bit before. And he thought, hey, samurai and ninja are cool. I should make those character classes in the game. Just because it was like to differentiate it. Also, it probably helped from like a legal standpoint. So I just slightly differentiate it from Dungeons & Dragons.
On that, really quick, I'm kind of curious, because D&D also put out a supplement they call Oriental Adventures, which lets you play as samurai and ninjas.
Ouch.
The name hasn't aged entirely well. But and they kept putting it out under that name forever, too. But I have to look and see when that came out, because this might act... I never thought about that until now.
That came out in...
That book.
That came out in 85, so that was later. But between the release of AD&D, or the release of original Dungeons & Dragons AD&D, there were a couple of magazine-only classes. And they did add a samurai and a ninja class. Those were intended to be an NPC class because they were overpowered. Yeah. But those never made it into the core books. But you did have official rules for those classes. But again, those were from magazines, which the creators may or may not have even read.
That's true. So, they kind of beat them to the punch, that maybe. Sort of. Parallel design or whatever that's called.
They did because of the TV show.
That's the official show, so...
Well, something I got to say about Wizardry, the video game, that people may not have actually played because it's from, like, 1982 or something.
81.
I wasn't listening.
Okay, that's good to know.
Don't listen to our show. We don't even listen to it.
It while we're talking, no. I like that it's got six... You get six people in your party, which is a little odd. It's usually four or something. This game goes with a whole six. And if you don't have all six and you beat enemies in it, it actually divides the same number of spoils and, I think, experience between whatever number you have, so it doesn't cheese you out like a lot of RPGs where they just kind of say, oh, they're knocked out, they don't get experience.
Yeah.
Instead,
they
don't get experience, but the rest of the party gets more, which is cool for something this old, I think.
Yeah, if you don't read the manual, you won't know this, but the way it works is like the first three characters in your party are in the front row, and the last three characters are in the back row, and they will never get touched by anything for the most part.
Yeah.
At least in the first like five levels
of the dungeon.
Can enemies
cast to the back row or have spells?
I don't think they might. Oh, yes.
Yeah,
magic using enemies can, yes. But they suck for like the first three stages.
I really like that there's a spell that's make everything quiet so no one can cast spells. I thought that was really cool.
That's an old D&D thing, too.
Yeah.
Song of Silence.
That's the one.
It's interesting because when they're in the back row, they can't do anything but parry or cast spells.
Oh.
So if you're like me and you had three fighters in the front because you don't want to die.
You can.
Which is a great idea if you don't want to die, three fighters in the front. And then I had a cleric, a thief, and a mage in the back row. The thief can't do jack. Because
that's right.
Because this game doesn't have the hide yet, and this game doesn't have ranged weapons. That comes in like Might and Magic or Bard's Tale, one of the two.
Yeah.
And so, we don't get them until like Wizardry 5.
No, I had the thief, so the thief could disarm chests, because that's a main thing in this game. Is yes. Like the dungeon has a few... Each level of the dungeon has a couple things, like treasures that you got to get to progress. But other than that, like the every other treasure in the game is like a loot drop. And most of the chests are trapped. It's very D&D, like old school pen and paper RPG in that respect. You've got to have somebody who can inspect the chest. Oh, this is a poison dart trap. Okay, who's going to disarm the poison dart trap? My thief will disarm the poison dart trap. What kind of trap is going to disarm? I just told you, it's a poison dart trap. And then you disarm it. And
you said you disarm it when the thief usually just blows it up in their face.
Well, yeah. Like,
what about my other?
Oh, really?
Yeah, that happens a lot.
Again, playing the NES game recently, I've never had a trap blow up.
That's really lucky. Yeah, see, gotta have
never. Yeah. No, like it's. I don't think it happens.
Oh, okay. My the PC version. He usually looks at the chest, goes, "Guys, it's a poison needle trap. Who's gonna disarm this?" And then I'm like, "Well, first off, it's you, jackass. And secondly, disarm the poison needle trap." He's like, "Okay." And then he comes back. It's like, "It's an explosion trap instead."
No, that never happened to me.
Oh, no. You got really lucky or the...
No, I think it's definitely the NES version of the game. Again,
yeah.
The creator's preferred version of the game, bugs notwithstanding. That didn't happen to me.
Maybe it's just a bit friendlier than that.
Yeah, it could be. Robert Woodhead is like, "My God, I was a monster."
No, I think it was just like he was trying to make the game accessible and was making it for a console audience and was thinking about some of these things and was like, "That's stupid. Like, that's not fair." Like,
to be honest, just for a game like, from
you know, you can fail to open the trap, but yeah. You will eventually succeed.
To be honest, I think this is actually quite accessible for a game from 1981. The game is a lot of menus, mm-hmm. and the actual play area is kind of small, and it's usually just the same three walls over and over again anyway.
Yeah.
But I think this is actually somewhat playable out of the box compared to a lot of other games from the time or later. There are some other RPGs where you probably won't even be able to start the game without the manual. And here, it's at least somewhat intuitive. And if you had played D&D at the time, which probably a lot of players had because it was really popular, then a lot of things were familiar. You probably know that you're not going to put the mage in the front row, provided you know that there's a front row in the first place. And even the elite classes are not completely new. So you might even be familiar with that if you've ever played Paladin, which you probably haven't because you never rolled the charisma needed for that.
Yeah.
But at least the concept was kind of on the table. And same goes for the weapons and some of the spells, even though the names are all somewhat strange. They're not as the like sober descriptive names.
Yeah, there's a most of the reason for that, and I can't remember it, but it has something to do with the way that data was stored or the way that they had to do it.
So
I wouldn't be surprised. Are they randomly generated or so? Or are they like puns or something like that?
No, there's just a... I don't think it was their good reason for it. I think it was just like the way they had to do it. They had a limit to the characters they could use. Yep. Or some, again, listen to the Retronauts episode. Much more informative from the guy who actually made the game who knows what he's talking about.
We're just four people reminiscing on a game we like.
They'll explain. Robert Wood explains all these details very well. It's a fantastic episode.
So
we don't need to do that.
One thing.
What we need to do is rank the game. Is there anything else we should talk about before we rank the
game? Yes, because you got to miss one of the best parts about playing this game on the PC, and it's the typing. Because on the PC version, you actually have to type trap names to disarm them. And
that's why. So that explains the spell thing.
And the spell thing,
But
going back to Taxes thing, there's a lot of games, even way into the 90s, where all the spells were in the manual. Like Dungeon Master does this, where it's like, well, we're not going to tell you all the spells. Go figure them out, and here's a couple in the manual. This game, if you just dig into your menus and you go, okay, what spells do I know? Okay, you know these spells. And there's a lot of other games that wouldn't tell you the name of the spells, and they'd use that as, like, copy protection. Which, the spells do, you have to have the manual, but you can kind of work it out eventually.
I was going to mention, when you cast spells in the PC version, which I really enjoy, you select spell, and then it won't tell you the spells that you have. You have to remember them or just kind of guess. But if you just put in the first letter of the spell and press enter, if you only have one spell of that letter, it'll say, "I'm going to cast this spell," because that's the only one you've got.
It's
you don't have to type the whole thing in.
Yeah, it's Zork functionality, right? Like, it'll go with whatever the only option is.
Yes, right.
You know? Yeah.
And it's actually really cool because, yeah, once you sort of play the game for a bit, you'll know what spells your characters have. So you don't have to type the whole spell. You can just be like, I need to use the healing spell. So it's that letter and that letter. That narrows it down. Enter. Yeah. And it, well, it does it. That.
Or you can play a console version of the game where that's not an issue and it's way more fun.
Although,
but
yeah, I like the spells theory here is that what happened is so Cirotech did develop a database program, like a management program before called InfoTree. So my personal theory is that this game is just that, but gone rogue.
I think that's right. Yeah, that again, I'm remembering this from like a year ago of listening to somebody else's podcast, but I think he does talk about that. There's a very good reason for like a good reason, and by good I mean they were novice programmers trying to make this work, and they were working with the tools they had, and one of those things was the database program. So yeah, that's part of the reason I think the game is so cumbersome to load up on an Apple II and all that.
Yeah,
it's so slow. Don't play
they didn't know what they were doing.
You really want a taste of history?
Let's rank Wizardry. This is going to be difficult.
Yeah, so we have NetHack at number 2.
It's not as, like, look, NetHack should not be that high, but it should be pretty high.
I'll say for the record, I don't think anyone has seriously suggested that NetHack is in the wrong place. Amongst people we've talked, I'm sure some people do feel that way.
I wouldn't say it's the wrong place. I do think that it's like...
It's one of our less controversial high ranks. I'll put it that way.
Okay, all right. Whatever. All right. That not
look, it's no Gain Ground, I'll tell you.
Gain Ground is a game that's accessible to the everyman.
Amazing ads about.
Yeah, it's also
episode.
A game the everyman will never complete.
Look, I got tons of compliments about Gain Ground. Everything was like, nope, nobody says like Gain Ground is garbage and ranking so high. Everybody's like, I love Gain Ground. I'm so glad you repped Gain Ground. And I'm like, hey, my pleasure, dude.
Okay, so let's start in the middle of the list here.
Better than
is
that.
This better than Golden Axe?
Yes.
Yeah. Golden Axe is awesome, but this game is better. Like, it's the thing is, it's like it's an accessible, super old, like paleo CRPG.
Yeah.
That's one thing I've mentioned in the beginning, but yeah, it has a certain purity, and I think that's I can appreciate that.
And a lot of depth for 1981.
It's got a whole 10 levels of depth, buddy.
Yeah, I was waiting for that. I was curious if it was going to be you or Xerxes.
And it does stuff that, again, like you look at, say, Etrian Odyssey, right? Etrian Odyssey is very much based on Wizardry in the way that it sets it up. So with the way that the dungeon works in Wizardry is that you've got an elevator in Wizardry in the dungeon. And so once you've gotten to the fourth floor, the elevator, you can go from the first floor to the fourth floor, or rather the basement floor 1 to basement floor 4 using the elevator. And that's really important. But you can't use the elevator to go from the first floor to the second or third floor. I mean, you can, but you can't get off the elevator. You just stop.
It's got 2 levels. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but that's exactly how Etrian Odyssey works. It's like you've got those like weird teleport points, but they only work every like 4 levels.
I think this is a very important thing that you've sort of gotten on with Wizardry. For its age, it is one of the fairest games that I have played in the RPG genre. It doesn't go out of its way to do horrible things to you for basically no reason.
Right.
Like, you get poisoned, but if you just get back up to the city, you just get unpoisoned. Resurrecting characters are still criminally expensive, but in the first game, at least, you can re-roll another character and just make them join your party, and that's, you know, you never lose that much. You never, even if you do a full party wipe, you just make up a bunch of other bozos,
right,
and you still have the map.
Right.
You
put
still
a new
know
character in
on.
The back row and go down and fight. Hey, on the first, and also like on the very first level of the dungeon, there's an enemy you can fight to grind, and it's just there for that purpose.
Oh yeah.
Murphy's Ghost.
I forgot about him. Okay. So to really throw things up, we have, parallel sort of grandfather of the genre, Dungeon Master at 95.
We also have Dragonstone Heart at 226.
I just want to say we've also got Wizardry. It's got ambition there as well with the 3 separate scenarios that are connected. Doesn't
I think
necessarily
that's really cool.
Yeah, that's for like this is really cool. Like, wow, I can buy a second game and just take and my party like an actual like.
We haven't even talked about how this pays off in Wizardry 4.
Oh, Wizardry 4. Yeah, that's the one where you play as
the bad guy. The evil wizard Wyrdna.
Yeah, so essentially you do the reverse thing. You're at the bottom of the dungeon.
Right.
And your job is to climb up.
And you fight adventurers.
And you fight adventurers who were submitted to Sirtec by people who played the first three Wizardry games.
Oh, yeah.
They're the party they're parties of adventurers from real players of Wizardry 1 through 3.
Which is brilliant.
Awesome.
The concept is
BioWare.
The
concept is awesome, but the execution is kind of terrible.
I mean,
Wizardry 4 is a miserable game.
Old school CRPG, yeah, the execution is clunky, all right, but the idea behind it is perfect.
It is great, yeah.
It's like, and you start out, like, in that game, you start out as pretty relatively powerful, so it's not, like, unfair. It's just, like, it's just instead of fighting monsters, you fight teams of adventurers.
Yeah.
And they are literally teams of adventurers.
That one is unfair because they snuck in and gave you limited key presses, which is the worst thing anyone has ever done in video games.
That is a bad idea.
We're not ranking Wizardry 4.
No, I just want to point out that if you're going to play the Wizardry series, the classic games, there is a payoff, right? And that's really cool. And also, you can go through Wizardry 3 and then transport your party to Bard's Tale and just stomp everything.
I have to try that someday. We'll have to rank Bard's Tale a little bit.
I've heard that they recently made a new Bard's Tale game.
Yes.
And they allowed you to do that still.
So they remastered the first three Bard's Tales and then they kept that feature in.
Yeah, that's it.
I think they had to bring it back. That whole thing was a mess. But once again, we're talking about Wizardry 1.
Right, I just want to point out that there's dividends that will extend to you if you play Wizardry.
Yeah, this game was built as like a role-playing engine almost. They're like, you like D&D? You like computers? Boy, have we got the thing for you.
And the thing is it also had cross-cultural appeal and influenced Japanese role-playing games in ways that are kind of invisible, I think, because of the way that those games developed. But it's, look, you check out HG101, the website, right? And you'll learn all about this. But it's games like Wizardry and Ultima that had the big impact on them. And it's just that they came to conclusions and things that we might not have come to, but that's what created that genre. But Wizardry is a major part of that. And that's a big reason why, again, had a cartoon, which is bonkers. You just think about that person.
Wizardry doesn't have animation, but there's a lot of flavor text in the fights, which I really love.
Yeah, again, when you find the special items and puzzle pieces or whatever it is that you need to progress through the game, there's like interesting, you know, flavor text. You're right.
Yeah, which is, you know, this is, you know, 1981. Like half the games would send you to the manual to read flavor text at this point. So. Even to just read the descriptions of the fights, it's a bit more exciting to play the game. I really like it.
This is tough.
It is.
So
it's really tough.
You were kind of pushing it lower. I'm going to mention that we put Ultima 7, The Black Gate, at 79. That was where Ultima 7 ended up.
I think that's because it's like an Ultima game that is still an Ultima game, but it's very playable right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't quite bury on the too many submenus.
No, it has font issues, right?
yeah, this is a hard, because I adore this game.
Tax was saying something, and I'm sure it was insightful. Tax, illuminate us.
Okay, so we've got Dragonstomper at 226.
Mm-hmm.
I think this should go above it, because this game had way more of an impact.
It did. Dragonstomper is kind of a fluke, but the interesting thing, as we said very recently about Dragonstomper, is that like it did the console RPG thing and figured it out for a very limited piece of hardware.
It did. But Dragonstomper, I could say, I think Dragonstomper is more impressive on a certain level because Wizardry does lift a lot from existing material, but its influence just way more far flung. It lasts until today. The last Wizardry game in Japan came only out a couple of years back.
Yeah, and I'm sure there will be another one. Like it's got some weird appeal to it, and I can't explain it. All I can say is that if you play like a relatively recent-ish remake of this game, you will probably, if you've like not cripplingly difficult like horrible RPGs, but if you like a good old-fashioned like go into the dungeon because whatever, like just go make it happen, dude. that's the kind of game this is, and it is fair and playable and weirdly addictive. And I was surprised to find myself so attached to this game so quickly, returning to it, because the only other time I played it was when I was really little, and I hated it because I'm like, I don't understand any of this.
Did you read the manual when you were little?
I couldn't read when I was little.
See, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
But,
no, I mean, it's just like, it was a lot of stuff that I had played a little bit of Dungeons and Dragons, but I couldn't really understand the rules. I had an older cousin who was the DM, and I basically just rolled with it. I didn't really know what was happening or why.
You kind of need to be able to basically understand the mechanics of a...
But this game, it really doesn't require you to understand that much. You just... The armor class thing is a little bit tricky,
It's the only thing, and they actually spend like a whole page explaining it in the manual, which I...
Yeah, I mean, but also you put on a better... Like, you put on chainmail, and your armor class goes to 4, and you put on, like, plate mail, and your armor class goes to 2, you figure it out really quick. Like, oh, lower number are... that's better.
It does put as much information as it can. I do want to say with the manual, I'll figure out a number very shortly, it's one of the best manuals I have read for this period because it's very light and very well presented. It's got these cute little drawings that look like way more cutesy and like Gary Larson-y or something. They're very... Because, you know, like, your D&D stuff is almost always just weird, semi-realistic amateur squiggles.
Yes.
I knew you were going to bring that up. There's a lot of little cartoons like this in old D&D books as well. Like the picture with like the fellow and the tank. That could totally be right out of like first edition or even OG D&D, or the one with the guy who's like floating the liquor bottle.
Yeah, it's very cutesy, and the manual reads more. It's got a lot of jokes in it, and they land pretty well. It's not great, but it's actually pretty fun to read, which is so important when you have to read a manual, which you really should. It also begs you to read the manual, which I love when a game begs you to read the manual. Like, stop playing the game, you're going to lose. Don't call us at 3 a.m. because you didn't read the manual.
I mean, you probably were calling Robert Woodhead at 3 in the morning back in those
He'd answer the phone.
He probably would, because he's probably addicted to playing Wizardry.
All right, numbers for Wizardry.
2. Damn it.
No, I'm trying that. 2.
No,
better than
that's
Outlaws
crazy.
At 136.
Yes!
Is this?
You son of a...
Again, I think that the main point to this game is, like, I don't want to say, like, everybody who likes RPGs or even CRPGs should play this game, but it's more like, if you want to get a taste of what the old school was like, and you don't want to, like, hate yourself and life and everything for trying, this is a good game. Just pick the most playable version of the game you can find and go with it. It's playable.
It's playable. It's disgustingly addictive. As long as you keep good notes for the record, like there's a spell that lets you teleport to anywhere on the map, and it will let you put in anything you want.
Yes.
But
you can't teleport yourself into solid rock. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
It's amazing.
You probably will do that if you just choose random coordinates.
Yeah.
I would say. Here's my suggestion. Above Sonic CD, but actually, yeah. I think that sounds
Where's
reasonable. That is 118.
Oh my god, why did it go that high?
Why not? That's still below a lot of other games.
That's actually really low for Sonic CD. You should be
Sonic
thankful.
CD is like everybody in the episode is like, well, it's the worst classic Sonic game, but...
I think the only people that really like Sonic CD were
yeah, but
on that
worst classic Sonic game makes it like better than like 90% of all Sonic games.
Barely. I had to edit that one. It was not a love fest.
Okay.
You're going to love editing this episode, though.
Yes.
This is going to be great. Okay, to be honest, I could also see this going maybe a little bit lower, maybe around 150.
Mostly, I'm just going with it's playable and it has a wide-spanning influence. Those are my
two. Better than Rayman 2, The Great Escape.
It is way better than Rayman 2, The Great Escape. What
I would say I like it better than Planescape Torment, even though I love Planescape Torment. That game is all story. This game is all gameplay, and it's surprisingly competent.
I've been up till 2 in the morning playing Wizardry. I have not been up till 2 in the morning playing Planescape.
You try and play Planescape at 2 in the morning, you will fall asleep. That's what's going to happen. It'll just keep throwing.
I've been playing a little Planescape Torment on Switch at 2 in the morning, I guess, but that's not... I've been playing it since 6.
You're a weird guy.
I need to get better sleep.
Yeah, I've been up at 2 in the morning talking about Planescape Torment on this podcast.
So. And Wizardry, so...
Yeah.
That is true as well.
What about above...
yeah.
I gotta go above Dragon's Dogma, right?
Yes, it does.
but it can't go above Suzuki Bakuhatsu because, like, that game is crazy.
Where the heck is Suzuki Bakuhatsu?
That's it. Suzuki Bakuhatsu is 144. That's really? The game where there's a bomb in the moon. Dragon's Dogma is at 146. So it's kind of like, for me, it's like, I don't know, above or below Her Story.
Well, I'm going to go above because I've been horribly addicted to this game for 20 years now, and I think I got to put in a good word for it.
I second that.
Well, I third that. That's where it
doesn't
goes.
Matter.
Boom! Suzuki Bakuhatsu. Cal, eat it.
I like this game.
You just
Wizardry, Ruby Grounds of the Mad Overlord. Thank you, Beast of Freddy, and thank you for your patience. And thank you, listeners,
I hope
for
we
your
did
patience.
All the justice also, in the world.
Give it a shot. Wizardry is pretty damn good for how old it is. See you later. That's all for this episode. Special thanks goes out to our lovely co-hosts and compatriots, our booking agent Jeff Rude, our theme song MC Norm, check him out at Normally Retro on Twitter, and our technical assistant, video editor, and scriptwriter Ed Burns. You can support this podcast by making a small monthly donation at patreon.com/HG101, I know I did, by subscribing to the HG101 YouTube channel, and by following at GC9X and at HG_101 on Twitter. You can also hang out with us at our Discord channel. It's at bit.ly/HGDiscord, but most importantly, help us spread the love of games by getting on iTunes, subscribing to HG101, and giving us a 5-star review. Do it because you like us and you want us to succeed. Until next time, keep keeping it real.